You're listening to the BBC World Service. I'm Judy Swallow. There's nothing new in the rhetoric from Baghdad today, the same tone of defiance here from Iraqi Trade Minister Mohammed Mehdi Salah, the same unlikely boast that Iraq will win the war.
We ask British people and American people either to surrender or to go home without additional loss in their blood and in their equipment, because who fights them is not only the military capability of Iraq, but the people of Iraq.
And the Iraqi Information Minister Mohammed Saeed al-Sahaf denied U.S. charges that Iraqi troops were donning civilian clothes in order to ambush American and British troops.
This kind of cheap propaganda by saying that the Iraqi military persons are disguising themselves with civilian clothes, this is nothing to do with facts and the truth. There is no Iraqi military disguising himself. Those are Iraqi civilians fighting against those invaders.
So, same rhetoric, but Saddam Hussein and his ministers must all be feeling pleased with themselves today. They've seen a number of setbacks for the U.S. military on several fronts. A suicide attack in Najaf in central Iraq, and U.S. troops massed around Baghdad reportedly told to pause for a few days and do nothing. And another public relations disaster for the U.S., the bombing of a marketplace with more than 50 civilians reported dead. We're joined now from Baghdad by our correspondent, Andrew Gilligan. Andrew, first of all, we've heard that the troops massed close to Baghdad have been told to pause. At least that's been reported. Does it therefore appear that the air campaign has been stepped up?
Yes, that's right. We are hearing a 4 to 6 day pause. And what we're also hearing is that that's because their supply lines are too extended to permit them to make the attack on Baghdad right now.
In that case, is it an intensified air campaign, you know, that they're now not being so concerned about civilian casualties, that they are going for more of the shock and awe, as it was called?
Well, the bombing has got noticeably heavier. They're dropping bigger bombs now than they were, and they are making the windows shake, the building is shaking. We've had continuous, rather heavy attacks all over the last 24 hours. The explosions do seem to be getting bigger.
And tell us about this attack on the market. Any clearer yet what sort of bomb actually caused it? An Iraqi missile or a cruise missile, a U.S. cruise missile?
Well, as I understand that the U.S. hasn't denied it was one of theirs, they're saying they're still investigating. And it does seem likelier that it was one of theirs than an Iraqi anti-aircraft missile, because it would have been difficult for an anti-aircraft missile to kill so many. But even if it was Iraqi, frankly, the people of this country and the people of the Arab world as a whole have already decided it's the Americans' fault. The doctor at the hospital said to me this morning, look, even if it was one of ours, we wouldn't be firing ours if they weren't firing theirs.
Andrew Gilligan in Baghdad, thank you. And of course, like all other reporters there, some of his movements are restricted and his reporting is monitored. Well, the main target for American-led forces around the southern city of Basra overnight has been the offices of the ruling Ba'ath Party. Military spokesmen say eradicating the party within the province is their main aim. Tim Franks, another of our correspondents, joins us from southern Iraq. Tim, what are they saying about their strategy now and their success rate?
Well, they seem to be saying, the military spokesman that we've been talking to, that they've made progress overnight. There was an airstrike by two American F-15 warplanes on a building in the middle of Basra. We're told by the Americans that it was bombed and completely destroyed, and that inside, again, in the words of the Americans, 200 members of the Iraqi terror regime, as they put it, were meeting, and that the building, because it was razed to the ground, they think that there were probably scores of casualties inside there. Along with that, just before daybreak in Basra, British troops using tanks and armored infantry launched a raid into Basra. Their target, again, a sort of symbolic target, it was going after the main statue of Saddam Hussein in the middle of Basra. We don't know if they managed to destroy it, which was their aim, but they are reporting that they destroyed two statues along with six tanks and six artillery pieces. So on the military front, at the very least, the British and the Americans are reporting progress.
But astonishing, Tim. I mean, they're actually saying that smashing a couple of statues of Saddam Hussein is progress.
It's extraordinary, isn't it? When you think of that list, it goes 2 statues, 6 tanks, 6 artillery pieces. You'd think that in order of sort of military priorities, it might be the other way around. But I think that just goes to underline how intent they are at the moment on eradicating, in their words, the Ba'ath Party influence. And this, I mean, they're quite open about that being the main aim of their military strategy at the moment is in a sense, a political aim. It's to undermine the central control here. And when you go out and about, and it's difficult when you're cooped up with the military as we are to go out and about, but when we've had the small opportunities to go out and about and talk to Iraqi civilians, you get an understanding as to why this is so important. We're talking to one man earlier on today who was saying, look, we don't like the regime here at all, but we have long memories. We remember what happened in the wake of the last Gulf War when we rose up here in the south and we were punished terribly by Saddam Hussein and the Iraqi government. We are too fearful to rise up again, and so we are not going to for the time being. We're going to let the American and the British forces do their work. And given how important it is, I think, to the American and British strategy that they use the Iraqis here in southern Iraq as some sort of lever, both on the ground sort of militarily and also psychologically over Baghdad, I think that these symbolic targets that they've got in terms of statues, that's why they are so important.
Tim Franks from southern Iraq, thank you. Well, moving now a bit further north to Nasiriyah. The U.S. Army says it's found a site where they claim chemical weapons are sighted. Andrew North, another of our correspondents, has just been to the site. He joins us from Nasiriyah. Andrew, what have you seen?
Well, that's right. It's actually the U.S. Marines who've taken control of this site. I'm not quite sure whether they're actually going as far at the moment as to say chemical weapons have been found there. What they have found and what I saw was large quantities of chemical warfare protection equipment, which, of course, have been found at some other sites as well, gas masks and this kind of thing. There was also what they said was a chemical decontamination unit. I'm not an expert on this kind of thing, obviously, so I couldn't verify that for myself. In addition, there were some very large quantities of ammunition found at the site. And I mean, we're talking about 3 large rooms piled high with crates of everything from machine gun bullets to large artillery shells, enough to keep a significant force in ammunition for quite some period of time.
Well, this is kind of the U.S. forces in search of the reason for the war as the war is being fought. They need to find these weapons of mass destruction, don't they, Andrew? What they've found in itself does not sound like damning evidence.
Well, that's right. It's too early to tell, so I think we've got to be careful with what they're saying, with what conclusions they may draw from what they found. What they're saying is that they're going to send experts there to assess the equipment, and indeed also I think some documents that they found, and then they will draw conclusions from that. I mean, certainly they're obviously very pleased at finding this very large ammunition cache, because of course ammunition from this cache has almost certainly been used in all the fighting that has been going on in and around Nasiriyah for the past week.
Andrew North in Nasiriyah, thank you very much indeed. Well, we've been getting several snapshots of what's going on across Iraq today. Let's pull it all together. We're joined by Paul Rogers, Professor of Peace Studies at Bradford University. He'll be with us for the next hour or so. Professor Rogers, first of all, do you see with this pause around Baghdad, intensified bombing, intensified action too around Basra, do you see a change in strategy?
Yes, I think very clearly the American forces have been stretched too thin. They've come up against much more opposition between Kuwait and the outskirts of Baghdad than they expected. And they frankly do not have even remotely the forces in place close to Baghdad to consider any kind of attack on the city. I think they're probably doing 3 things now. One is to try and bring forces to bear on the opposition that they're finding in Najaf and elsewhere. I think secondly, they're going to reinforce very heavily the overall troop concentrations, and that may take 2 to 3 weeks. And thirdly, they look like they are intensifying the bombing campaign quite considerably, going for Ba'ath Party headquarters and the rest. And that, of course, means that if they're not going for purely military targets, there's going to be a sharp increase in the civilian casualties. So overall, I think it does represent quite a considerable change of tactics. Really, have them having had experienced over the first 9 or 10 days of the war some quite unexpected reversals to what they intended to do.
Yes, but military planners always say that as soon as the first bullet is fired, the plan goes out of the window. Isn't this just adjustments that they found? Yes, there is resistance in Basra, that Saddam Hussein moved his militias down there and to Najaf and to Nasiriyah, and therefore what they found they have to do is actually take on these fronts one at a time to clear the supply lines. Is this a disaster?
It has the makings of a disaster. I think the problem is that, yes, as soon as any kind of conflict starts, the planning goes out of the window. But on that basis, you have reinforcements and spare capacity ready to handle that. The United States does not have that. The troops are not in Kuwait. The equipment is not in Kuwait. They went into the war really probably prematurely, even from the point of view of their own military planners. And they now have quite a long pause before they can regroup and build up supplies, troops and tanks and the rest. Their real problem, though, is that however long that takes, it could take them into the latter part of April, the beginning of May, when the climate is getting such that it becomes much more difficult for them to operate. This is the real dilemma for them.
But won't they get some reinforcements from those who should have comprised the Northern Front, the 60,000 troops that would have come in through Turkey and now coming into the Gulf, are they not?
Those will be the first reinforcements, and the equipment is already heading for Kuwait, having largely come through the Suez Canal. But the problem is it will take probably 2 weeks to get the equipment into Kuwait, unloaded. The Kuwaiti ports are not huge for this kind of thing. Bring the troops in and marry them up to the equipment. Once you have the troops there, you then can start the process of moving them forwards. But we're still talking about maybe 2 or 3 weeks before they can get through to the outskirts of Baghdad.
Professor Paul Rogers, for the moment, thank you. But as I said, you'll be with us for quite a bit longer. You're listening to the BBC World Service. Now to events here in Britain, and 23 British soldiers have so far died in the Gulf. British public opinion has swung behind Prime Minister Tony Blair since fighting began. But it's often said that once the body bags of soldiers start arriving, the public will lose their appetite for military campaigns. Vicky Young, our political correspondent, is at Westminster. She joins us now. Vicky, are we seeing the public opinion start to swing against the war as the death toll mounts?
Not yet. I think probably it is too early for that. As you were saying, the bodies of the first British soldiers to be killed in action are being flown back to England today. And I think, of course, it's going to be an incredibly poignant moment. The British Defence Secretary, Geoff Hoon, will be there at the airbase for the arrival of those bodies. And I think, really, for the British cabinet here who met this morning, the war cabinet, it's, you know, a very difficult couple of days for the coalition forces. So I think a poignant reminder there, if one were needed, really, of the realities of war. I think what's happened is when the troops started to go in, public opinion, if the opinion polls are right, seemed to swing behind Tony Blair. I think there's certainly an element of, you know, our boys and girls are out there putting their lives on the line, and it's, you know, up to the public to get behind them and support them. They don't want to hear all this negative news coming from home. They want to know that everyone is here supporting them. But I think you're right that the danger, of course, is that once we actually start seeing the reality of coffins coming off planes and coming home, then that could change.
Of course, not to be too maudlin about it, it can have the reverse effect, can't it, Vicky? Is that sympathy for the relatives of those victims actually rallies public sympathy or public support around the troops even more?
Yes, that's certainly the case. I mean, people don't tend to stage large-scale marches throughout the country in favour of war. I mean, there's a small demonstration going on today in one of the British cities here, a city which is very much linked to the armed forces. Just a few hundred people wanting to get together and say, hang on a minute, you know, we're fed up with all these pictures of people protesting against war. We want to show the troops that we're supporting them. But I think the other thing here as well is also been those pictures of Iraqi civilians being injured. And we've had that reports there of a second bombing of a Baghdad market. And it's not just the effect on the Arab nations. I think home here as well, people have heard Tony Blair talk about the dispute not being with the Iraqi people, that he wants to liberate them, the talk of precision bombing and keeping down the number of civilian deaths. And I think, of course, those kind of pictures are going to say, well, hang on a minute, we trusted him and now it doesn't seem to be going quite right. And I think that's going to be a problem as well.
What does Tony Blair need to happen to keep public opinion on his side, need to happen soon?
I think the problem is that all this talk of getting bogged down, of the military plans not going quite right, none of that is going to help. And he has certainly been very, very careful never to set a timetable. I think privately they say that, you know, they point to the fact that it took 78 days in Kosovo to dislodge Milosevic's forces. And, you know, we're only a couple of weeks in here and people are already making some kind of comparison with Vietnam, which went on for years. They just really feel that is going too far too soon. I think they partly blame it on the 24-hour news coverage by saying that people expect things to happen so quickly now that, you know, you've got to look at the bigger picture, really. And I think Tony Blair's line is very much that just because it's difficult doesn't mean it's wrong, that he passionately believes that he's doing the right thing here. And he says, you know, he always knew it was going to be difficult. And I think that it's really preparing his own backbenchers for that. That's the big problem for him in the long term.
Vicky Young, thanks very much for joining us. Vicky Young, our political correspondent, speaking to us from Westminster. Well, it's been a week since the first casualties of war began arriving back in America. One of the first men to die in Iraq was a young black man called Kendall Watersby, whose father accused President George W. Bush of taking his only son away from him. That scene and the more recent sight of a black American woman nursing a foot injury among the prisoners of war in Iraq has brought home the fact that thousands of African Americans are laying their lives on the line. But most black Americans vote for the opposition Democratic Party, and a recent poll showed that only 44% support the war. Matthew Wells reports from Atlanta, Georgia.
The streets of Atlanta hum to the latest hip-hop beat as young, mainly African-American clubgoers queue outside a venue to celebrate the appearance of a basketball star. Almost two-thirds of the city's residents are black, and the majority believe the president was wrong to invade Iraq. Leante Miller doesn't accept Mr. Bush's claim to the White House, let alone the alleged links between Saddam and bin Laden.
How do we know he's linked up with him? We don't know. We just going by what Bush is saying.
Isn't the president's word enough and the word of the administration? You need more evidence.
Why is his word have to be enough when we had ballots thrown away? What the hell? He ain't supposed to be president.
Naked anger towards the president and his decision to send troops into potential harm's way is commonly felt here. But it's matched by more subtle analysis too. Jay Corbett, standing on the steps of Shadows nightclub, has a more theoretical approach to why his country's at war.
450-plus years, we were damn patriotic by force. You know, we built the country by cheap labor. The only two resources in the world is natural resources and human resources. So when you look at how we project ourselves in a war, it doesn't benefit us. It benefits corporate America. They can sell more cars, more machinery, more computers, more fiber optics, and that'll create jobs here, and, you know, they pay us back in oil.
Under the gleaming dome of the state capitol building, Republicans control the Senate, while Democrats control the House. Georgia has one of the largest black caucuses in the United States. 24-year-old Representative Alicia Thomas is its youngest member. She's in no doubt that African Americans feel remote from the president's war on terror.
We have been terrorized since we've been on American soil. And so we believe in general that war is always the last thing that you do.
Isn't this war about releasing a whole people overseas from terror? That's what the president says.
Well, that's what he says, but we're not real sure what it's about.
How long have y'all heard me say that?
Too long.
There's a functional way that we must do it.
A meeting of the Georgia Coalition for the People's Agenda downtown, a black forum that includes diverse shades of political opinion. Now that the war is in progress, nearly all African Americans are offering the troops their support and backing a successful campaign. One of the speakers at the meeting is James Quarterman, a city commissioner who's also standing for office as a Republican. He says black America has woken up to the Iraqi regime's true intentions.
Now that they're seeing where they're using people as human shields and some of the other things that they're doing, and as a nation, you have to just say, well, wait a minute, you can't do that. So I think African Americans are coming on board now in great numbers and seeing the need to put a type of tyrant government like this at rest.
Let freedom ring from Lookout Mountain of Tennessee. Let freedom ring from every hill and molehill of Mississippi, from every mountainside.
Let freedom ring. The unmistakable oratory of Atlanta's most famous campaigner, Martin Luther King. When the president talks of exporting freedom to Iraq, it's a precious concept to those who stood alongside Dr. King in the civil rights struggle of the 1960s. Dr. Joseph Lowery is one such man. He wears the collar of his Christian ministry under an old-fashioned three-piece suit and shakes his head with sorrow.
There's no question in my mind who Saddam Hussein is.
he needs to go. I don't have any doubt in my mind. But the larger question for us is, who are we? And are we adopting the means and measures of those we oppose?
Do you think that Black Atlantans feel instinctively just less patriotic, less committed to this war?
True, authentic patriotism is measured in terms of what's in the best interest of your country. This war is politically, morally, spiritually, and economically a disaster.
And that report from Atlanta, Georgia, was by Matthew Wells. You're tuned to the BBC World Service in London. A reminder of our main news developments today. Bombing attacks are continuing on the Iraqi capital, Baghdad, after Iraq said a missile killed more than 55 civilians at a market in the city. U.S. military officials say several American soldiers have been killed in an apparent suicide attack on a checkpoint near the city of Najaf. The Americans also say their aircraft have destroyed a building in the southern city of Basra, where they believe 200 Iraqi paramilitaries were meeting. And Iraq has accused the American-led forces of deliberately destroying food stores in Basra. Those are the main headlines at the moment. Let's take a break now and get the sport with Colin Maitland. Hi, Colin.
Hello, Judy. European and African football takes the sporting centre stage today in the European qualifiers for Portugal 2004. The defending champions, France, take on Malta. A victory, as expected for France, would put them 9 points clear at the top of their group. In the pick of the other games, England are away to Liechtenstein, and although this should be an easy victory for England, their manager Sven-Göran Eriksson is warning them that anything could happen. Some of the other European qualifiers include the Dutch against the Czech Republic, Poland against Hungary, Germany take on Lithuania, Ukraine plays Spain, Italy versus Finland, and Wales take on Azerbaijan at the Millennium Stadium in Cardiff. In qualifying matches for the African Cup of Nations, Sierra Leone and Morocco meet in Freetown later today. Both sides have won their opening two games. Tennis next, and Serena Williams and Jennifer Capriati meet later today in the final of the prestigious Miami tournament, regarded as an unofficial fifth Grand Slam, while Andre Agassi and Albert Costa play for the right to take on Carlos Moya in the men's final. Reporting from Florida, Jonathan Overend.
It's a repeat of last year's final, and the hope is that it will be just as competitive. 12 months ago, Capriati was close to winning the first set, and in the second, squandered 7 set points. But ultimately, Williams was a straight sets winner, and it's that ruthless streak which sets Serena apart. Jennifer will have to be at her absolute best and rely on a Williams off day. That's just the way it works these days. After that, it's Andre Agassi against Albert Costa for the right to meet Carlos Moya in the men's final. Agassi looking for a third successive Miami title, but Spaniard Costa has impressed with his hardcourt play and shouldn't be underestimated.
And finally, the Australian batsman Damien Martin will miss the start of the forthcoming cricket tour of the West Indies because of injury. He fractured his right index finger while fielding during the World Cup. That's the sport, Judy.
With Colin Maitland. Don't forget, you can keep up with sport and, probably more to the point at the moment, events in Iraq on our website, which is bbcnews.com. You're tuned to the BBC World Service, broadcasting from London.
The BBC is distributed in the US by PRI and is made possible by the Capital Group Companies, investing for individuals and institutions throughout the world, and sponsor of the American Funds Group of Mutual Funds, and by Merck, a research-driven pharmaceutical company, discovering, developing, manufacturing, and marketing a broad range of human and animal health products and services. Merck, committed to bringing out the best in medicine. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by American Airlines, offering a new way to travel between Boston and Washington, D.C. on American Eagle regional jets with 7 flights every business day to Ronald Reagan National Airport. K Jewelers, where every diamond is hand-selected. 15 Boston area locations. K Jewelers, every kiss begins with K. At Harvard Pilgrim Healthcare, working to make healthcare easier for members, providers, employers, and brokers by bringing personal healthcare support to the web at harvardpilgrim.org. Stay with WBUR for continuing coverage of the war in Iraq, and to see photos and maps of the push into Iraq, you can log on to our website at wbur.org. Our supporters include Wellington Management Company, providing investment advice to clients worldwide, Nortec, creating building products to help improve the comfort and security of homes and workplaces around the world, and Essex Partners, providing career advice, consulting services, and new opportunities to senior executives in transition, in Boston and on the web at essexpartners.com. The weather forecast, mostly cloudy today, a chance of showers later this afternoon, mild and breezy, highs in the 60s, turning colder tomorrow. It's 7:30, this is WBUR.
BBC News with Jill Anderson. American-led forces have kept up their bombing of Baghdad. In the latest of a wave of raids, explosions were heard in Baghdad's southern outskirts. The Iraqis say 68 people have been killed in the past day of attacks on Baghdad, among them 55 whom Iraq says were killed by a missile in a crowded marketplace on Friday night. United States military officials say a number of American soldiers have been killed in an apparent suicide attack on a military checkpoint near the Iraqi city of Najaf. The Americans also say their aircraft have destroyed a building in Basra, where they believed 200 Iraqi paramilitaries were meeting. The Iraqis have accused American and British forces of deliberately targeting food stores in the southern city of Basra with artillery fire. The Minister for Information, Mohammed Saeed Asahaf, also rejected charges by the American-led forces that Iraqi soldiers have been carrying out attacks while disguised as civilians. United States military officials are refusing to comment on a report that they've decided to pause their push on Baghdad for several days. The BBC defence correspondent says all indications from the battlefield suggest a pause has been ordered. He said it'll give the Americans time to secure their supply lines, which have been vulnerable to attack from Iraqi irregular forces. A missile's exploded near a seafront shopping mall in Kuwait City, slightly injuring two people. Kuwaiti officials say they think it was fired from the Four Peninsula on the southern tip of Iraq, an area British forces had announced as captured in the first few days of the invasion. North Korea says it will strengthen its defences to avoid what it calls the miserable fate that's befallen Iraq. Syria and Iran have dismissed allegations by the United States that they're interfering in the war in Iraq. Syria described as unfounded and irresponsible claims by the American Defence Secretary that it was channeling military supplies to Iraqi forces.
You're listening to the BBC World Service. I'm Judy Swallow. The military planners in the Gulf cannot have been pleased when they turned on the news this morning. The headlines were another mass killing of civilians by a stray bomb in Baghdad and reports that the US advance on the capital has stalled. So let's hear what they've been saying to try to seize the PR initiative. My colleague Owen Bennett-Jones is in Kuwait City. He joins us now live. Owen, you've just been to the British military briefing. What were they saying?
Well, they were saying that their control of the Basra province, which is what they have responsibility for in southern Iraq, is improving and that the area is becoming more secure. At the same time, they concede that they are unable to dislodge Saddam Hussein loyalists from Basra, Iraq's second city. It seems to go like this. I mean, at the moment, the British, I think, can move freely in the daylight hours only in the border village of Safwan, in the port of Umm Qasr. And I think they're also getting a tighter grip on the town of Al-Zabaya, which is quite close to Basra. But, you know, those are small gains after 10 days of fighting. And I think that gives an impression of the scale of the challenge that the coalition faces when it comes to controlling Iraq as a whole. Well, I've been talking with the British military spokesman, he's Colonel Chris Vernon, about the situation in the south now. And I asked him how the British are trying to win over the support of people in southern Iraq.
We've identified very clearly the Ba'ath Party as the main target. They are the political structure that holds down the people. They're also controlling militarily the irregulars. So we are totally focused on the eradication and removal of that element.
And how are you going about that?
We have mounted operations into Al-Zabar, both from the air and on ground. Their headquarters no longer exists. We have lifted a very senior politician who is talking very sweetly indeed. And we've now got a position in Al-Zabar, and increasingly, day by day, we're getting aid in there, and the situation becomes more benign.
So you're relying on local civilians to tell you where Ba'ath Party officials are, and then sitting on the outside of these towns, going in and trying to snatch them?
We've got more than local civilians telling us where they are, but I'm not going to tell you how we get that sort of information. The other angle to it is, therefore, let's target them. We're trying to drive a wedge between the Ba'ath Party and the people. So how do we play the people? We're into hearts and minds here. Classic counterinsurgency hearts and minds operation. Talking to them, gaining their confidence, bringing in humanitarian aid. All this will help. And what we're detecting is they are very, very scared. The legacy of when they were put down last time when they rose up sinks very deep in their psyche, and that's what we've got to play against.
Tell us about the humanitarian aid. The Sir Galahad arrived at Umm Qasr and that aid has been unloaded. What will happen to it now?
Well, that is destined initially for Safwan, the village just over the border, Al-Zubayr, the town we are now broadly insecure, but primarily it's Basra. Now, we can't get it in there yet. We acknowledge that, and therefore we've got to keep working in that Basra problem. One of the issues with that aid and the aid that's coming over from Kuwait is we've got to, we think, pull it under a military coherence and framework, because we've got NGOs coming in over the border, very well intentioned indeed. We've got international aid organisations. What we're asking them to do is work with us so we can provide the structure and indeed with the framework protection for them to operate and distribute the aid effectively.
But surely it'll be the military distributing the aid at this stage, won't it?
Yeah, we are. Al-Zubayr, for example, we're doing it there. We're actually going to start doing distribution points on the outskirts of Basra as well. But the bigger aid programme, which has got to be bigger than just the military doing this, we want to bring under some degree of military structure.
But do the international aid organisations want to work with the military? I imagine not.
There's always some reluctance, as you will know from Yugoslavia, former Yugoslavia and elsewhere. But I think they probably realise that altruistically it's a practical reality.
They have no choice but to do it under your control.
I think they realise that if their aim is to effectively distribute our aid in the rear area of a war zone, doing it with the military is the optimum method.
Colonel Chris Vernon there on the military situation and some of the aid issues that are arising in southern Iraq, and clearly getting the aid to the people who need it isn't going to be easy. Back to you in London, Judy.
Owen Mellett-Jones in Kuwait City, and we'll pick up that theme because the United Nations has launched a $2 billion aid appeal and agreed the resumption of the Oil for Food programme. Any number of agencies have launched individual appeals, but if they get the money, can they get the aid to those in need? Carol DeRoy is head of the Iraq office for the UN children's charity UNICEF. He pulled out just before the bombing started, so how quickly did he think they'd be able to get aid on the ground in Iraq?
We've designed a program to be able to move in as soon as there is humanitarian access, either in parts of the country or in the whole country. And we've got, at this moment, 200 local staff inside the country, 50 international staff around, and the idea is to move in as quickly as possible.
When you talk about as soon as you can get humanitarian access, what do you mean? Because every major city at the moment is a battlefront.
Well, in the north at this point, we have 140 staff. There's quite a bit of mobility there. We're still very busy. We can do our things there. Even in Baghdad, with daytime bombing, we've got 60 staff in Baghdad. Some 20 have been coming to work on a daily basis. It's becoming much more difficult because of the daily bombing, but we've been able to do our work under difficult circumstances, but still going on, rehabilitating generators, putting in place water bladders, water tankering operations, so that what has happened in Basra does not repeat itself in Baghdad. This is what we have been focusing on over the last weeks.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned Basra and Baghdad. Surely they are the places most in need. I mean, what chance of getting access to them?
Regarding Basra, we have now on the border 40 tankers filled with water, ready to move in, 55 water bladders, 500 tons of high-protein biscuits, oral rehydration salts, all the kinds of stuff you need to deal with a diarrhea crisis. We are ready to move in. We have linkages with the ICRC who are in Basra. They have a very small team there, but we are linked up with them. We should be able to slip through the humanitarian aid, bladders and so forth in the next day or so, and move in with the tankers and the rest of the aid, hopefully as soon as possible.
Tell us about your logistics. I mean, are you going to US and British forces and say, give us the protection to get in?
We don't have direct linkages. We have indirect linkages. I know that DFID is on the ground in Kuwait, USAID and others. So the humanitarian branches of the coalition countries, they are present. These are the people we work with.
Is money a key? I mean, the UN passed the resolution last night to restart the Oil for Food program. You might ask where they're going to get the money from the oil when the oil industry is at a standstill. But is money the key?
Well, money is this appeal is absolutely crucial because the Oil for Food program, although it has now been authorized to be revitalized, there is no oil being pumped, so there's no money. This appeal is a buffer in between, is a transition resource package for the humanitarian aid to be made possible. Remember that The most countries were very reluctant to provide money just before the war for preparing, because they did not want to send the wrong signals. UNICEF, for example, we had $10 million and 3 months of time to prepare ourselves. Very, very limited. We need money now to go back in as soon as possible with a substantive humanitarian package.
Carol DeRoy of UNICEF, he was head of their Iraq office until the war started. You're listening to the BBC World Service in London. Now, the contract to manage the port of Qasr in the south has just been awarded to an American company by the American government. President George W. Bush has allocated $1.7 billion for reconstruction projects in Iraq. But on whose authority? Well, nobody, it seems. Dan Roberts is the industrial editor of the Financial Times. Dan Roberts, it looks like a stitch-up, is it?
Well, I think it's too early to tell, in the sense that the contracts we're seeing awarded at the moment are all fairly small scale and immediate work, putting all five ports run again. The contracts that companies are most concerned about are the longer term infrastructure rebuilding projects, rebuilding bridges, rebuilding telephone exchanges, that sort of work, which really will be awarded by whoever's running Iraq in 6 months' time. And at the moment, as you know, that's very much up in the air.
But wouldn't you have thought that a contract to run the port of Qasr, that during wartime it would be run by the military, and the US has said it is committed to Iraqis running their own affairs?
Well, I think the contract we saw awarded this week, I don't know, I can't remember the exact figure, but I think it was less than $10 million, which, given the cost of doing an operation like this, I imagine is not going to buy you very much. So we're probably talking about a few weeks just so that some of these aid ships can start arriving. At the moment, we've seen no contracts that are of the sort that will last years and years. Clearly, there is an issue that as those contracts are awarded, U.S. companies look to be in pole position to pick them up, and there will be political ramifications from that.
Being terribly cynical about the whole thing, if U.S. companies manage to get most of the contracts for rebuilding Iraq, paid for the aid money, which of course would come through the international community, would that more or less make up for the cost of the war?
I very much doubt it. I'm not in a position to do the sums, but I mean, I think the sorts of money we're talking about, $1.9 billion or so US dollars that the US government has allocated so far, compared to estimates of the war of anything up to $100 billion, clearly it's not a reason for going for war, if that's what you're talking about.
Well, certainly not, no. But, I mean, if we look at the cost sheet, the early ideas of contracts being awarded. I understand that some have been awarded already for reconstruction, all to American companies. One, a subsidiary of Halliburton, which Vice President Dick Cheney used to run. Is that true?
I think, yes, that Halliburton has picked up some work to help put out oil fires, although the difficulty with Halliburton is, as well as having links to Dick Cheney, it's also one of the main experts in putting out oil fires. So, I mean, there is a difficulty, whatever they do there, if they don't give it to these companies, there isn't the expertise elsewhere necessarily to do it. But going forward, I think all these sorts of contracts we're seeing at the moment are largely red herrings. The big contracts are going to be the ones to rebuild the country. And if they are done under the UN Oil for Food Programme, the UN has very strict controls on how contracts are awarded, and they go out to competitive tender. So it'll be much harder to stitch these things up if that's what people are concerned about.
Dan Roberts of the Financial Times, thanks for joining us. Now to Iraq, where Iraqi satellite television resumed broadcast today after a gap of 12 hours. The station went off air on Friday after Allied airstrikes and after an early interruption on Tuesday night when American-led forces targeted the main television station in Baghdad, causing serious damage. So how are the Iraqi broadcast media responding to the attacks? Still with us, you may have heard him earlier, Paul Rogers, Professor of Peace Studies at Bradford University, and John Andrew, our correspondent at the BBC's monitoring service, which monitors news from around the world. Professor Rogers, first of all, how important is the Iraqi satellite media? I mean, do Iraqi people actually believe it?
I don't know whether they believe it, but at a time like this, they would certainly turn to it because there is a tremendous thirst for knowledge and information from them. So it is significant. There is also a certain sense of symbolism in the Iraqis doing their best to keep different forms of broadcasting going, even when the television station is targeted and transmitters are targeted as well. So it becomes something of almost political importance rather than something which is believed intrinsically by people in Iraq, where there may be a large number of people who will be listening to both the BBC World Service, Radio France International, and some of the Arabic channels that are available by radio rather than by satellite.
So, John, tell us what the diet is like on Iraqi TV and radio, national TV and radio.
Well, Iraqi satellite television. Remember, there are two services we're talking about here. There's the domestic Iraqi television. Our monitoring of that has shown that that has not been on the air very much. But I have to say that that is based on a listening station in Jordan. So although we don't pick up the domestic signal there, it may well still be on in Baghdad. The satellite service is more aimed at other Arab countries and, of course, at Europe. And that's been showing a diet really largely of patriotic scenes, statues, of Saddam himself at various ceremonies, people singing patriotic songs, and that has gone on interspersed with war footage. And we've had on this morning, for instance, the images from last night's attack in the marketplace. They've been on. We had just a few minutes ago shots of what were claimed to be American tanks that had been abandoned at Najaf. That's the kind of thing we're getting, a mix of propaganda and of some war reporting as well.
And how has the bombing campaign actually affected broadcasts?
Well, it has disrupted them, certainly. For instance, Baghdad State Radio, which we're talking about just now, that has been badly affected. And what's been happening there is that the American psychological broadcasts, the so-called PSYOPs radio broadcasts, have often been taking over the frequencies that were occupied by Baghdad Radio. These broadcasts operate from really converted transport planes, and they're able to beam quite powerful signals, both radio and television, over the areas that they fly over. Some of these broadcasts are aimed at civilians, and this one, which we'll hear now, is aimed at Iraqi troops.
O troops of Iraq, you are fighting for a tyrannical leader and an unjust cause. Your families miss you. Return peacefully to your families. Return to safety.
So those are the sort of broadcasts we've been getting, and quite blatant propaganda, if you like. I mean, it's not exactly subtle, but it's been going on not just since the war began, but for about 3 months before. And we know also, we've had reports that the Americans are also, or have been, dropping wind-up radios people can use to access these broadcasts. But how much effect they have, really, we haven't been able to measure.
Not very subtle. I was wondering, John, if Iraqi state television and radio trying to actually target American troops, trying to, you know, have some propaganda in that direction.
Well, I mentioned the tanks that that they showed a few minutes ago. Obviously, they will exploit whatever images that they can. But on the whole, no. I think what's interesting is how they've managed to stay on the air. A lot of people here, a lot of experts I've spoken to here, believe that they've stayed on the air by investing very heavily since the last Gulf War in a system of fiber optic cables in and around Baghdad, and perhaps even further afield than that. Very extensive, very expensive, and the belief is that if one part of that network is knocked out, as it were, they can route signals to another. They obviously need relays to keep the signal going, and they could be targets. But it's also interesting, engineers here say it's surprising that the Americans haven't really targeted the transmitters. They're the important thing. If you knock out the transmitters, then you can stop the broadcast. And that certainly happened during the Kosovo campaign. It doesn't seem to have happened in this war so far.
Professor Rogers, from both sides, the U.S. and their own state media, Iraqis seem to be getting blatant, basic propaganda. The Iraqis, certainly in the big cities, are not a naive people. Do you think they're snickering under their breath at both sides?
I think there may be an element of that. People tend to forget that in spite of all the problems of a very brutal dictatorship, Iraq essentially is a country in which people are very well educated. Lots of people have gone through the universities. And I think there is a sort of a stand-back independence that is probably much greater than people suspect. Also, one suspects that many people in Iraq do have a capability some way or other to latch onto the foreign media, both from the region and even more broadly. So, yes, I think there is an extent to which they can, if not be objective, at least get a wider feel of what is actually happening.
Professor Paul Rogers of Bradford University and John Andrew of our monitoring service for the moment. Thank you both indeed. You're listening to the BBC World Service in London. Now let's look at events elsewhere. Two more flashpoints. We begin with North Korea. And while diplomacy may have lost out to military action as far as the American-led war on Iraq is concerned, can a possible confrontation between the U.S. and North Korea, another member of the so-called Axis of Evil, be avoided? America wants Pyongyang to make concessions over its suspected nuclear weapons program. Washington has asked the North Koreans to either disarm or allow weapons inspections. This morning, the North Koreans responded. Here's what the ruling party daily newspaper, Rodong Sinmun, had to say in their commentary.
It is too early to make a conclusion on the outcome of the Iraqi war, but it is clear that the destiny of Iraq is at stake due to its concession and compromise. The Democratic People's Republic of Korea would have already met the same miserable fate as Iraq's had it compromised its revolutionary principle and accepted the demand raised by the imperialists and their followers for nuclear inspection and disarmament.
And the commentary concluded,
no one should expect the Democratic People's Republic of Korea to make any slightest concession or compromise. Those who stage saber-rattling against it had better stop it.
Well, there you are. I bet the Americans are scared about that. What do they make of that rhetoric in neighboring South Korea, where over 500,000 troops are based? Ben Lim is the foreign affairs advisor to the chairman of the ruling party. Ben Lim, thanks for joining us. Do those words, that harsh rhetoric, that warlike rhetoric from North Korea worry you?
Yeah. I believe the North Koreans should not make the impression that they are making. They are taking advantage of the Iraqi war situation. At the brink of Iraqi war, the North Koreans reported about the war without any political commentary, and that was good. But it seems to me that they are following the development in Iraq rather closely. They may have been encouraged to see that the British-American attack on Iraq has been slowing down a little bit in the past few days. And also they've been noticing the fact that the anti-war movement around the world is growing in these days. Particularly the anti-war movement in South Korea is growing day by day. And I hope that the North Koreans do not miscalculate or misinterpret these developments.
Misinterpreted in what way? I mean, it has been suggested that perhaps Kim Jong-il, the North Korean leader, is annoyed that so much attention is on Iraq and he is being ignored, or conversely, that he's using this space when attention is directed totally on Iraq to get up to mischief, to intensify his nuclear weapons program. Which theory do you go with?
Well, there is a possibility that they may as I mentioned, miscalculate the situation and then try to speed up the nuclear development program of their own. But I think that will be a great mistake. They should not underestimate the resolve of the South Korea and the United States to stop them from doing so.
Really? You think the United States is engaged? Because it would seem that you are really pretty well down their pecking order of priorities at the moment. I know Colin Powell, the U.S. Secretary of State, is meeting your foreign minister, but I mean, it's not his priority, it's not their priority, is it?
It is true that the U.S. is deeply involved with the Iraqi and they can at least afford these, to take care of the North Korean situation.
What are you asking Colin Powell to do? Are you saying, look, you have to engage with North Korea, you need to go, you need to offer them their concessions, they're demanding? What are you saying to the Americans?
The Americans should also refrain from making any inflammatory statement or engage in an act which might be misinterpreted by the North Koreans as quote-unquote hostile. So they are not doing that because they are, as I mentioned, deeply involved in the Iraq. They cannot afford, to do anything at the moment about the North Korean situation. So I think in this critical situation, North Koreans should also not make any hostile gesture or hostile statement, because doing so would be rather counterproductive.
Ben Lim in Seoul. Thank you. Ben Lim, who's foreign affairs advisor to the chairman of the ruling party. Well, now to another ignored flashpoint, Zimbabwe, where the government has called for the detention of the opposition leader, Morgan Tsvangirai, who's currently on bail while his trial on charges of plotting to kill President Robert Mugabe continues. The government accuses him of seeking to cause unrest and civil commotion. His response: President Mugabe has been using the diversion of the war in Iraq to crack down hard on his critics in the opposition MDP with a campaign of mass arrests and beatings. Mr. Tsvangirai told reporters the government had been out targeting ordinary people.
The regime has once again declared war against the people. As a result, hospitals, police stations are teeming with men, women and children, with the serious injuries arising from the wave of retribution and the reprisals.
The atmosphere in Harare is obviously highly charged. It's been a week of rising violence and tension in the run-up to by-elections this weekend in two constituencies of Harare. The polls have now opened. ZANU-PF, the ruling party, are insisting they'll win back the seats from the MDC. With me here in the studio is George Shearer, a ZANU-PF supporter here in London. George Shearer, first of all, is the ruling party using the inattention of the world to get up to mischief?
No, there was a stairway mass strike organized by the opposition. It took 6 months for them to organize, which left an orgy of violence, buses bombed, bridges bombed, children having to run away from buses taking them to schools. Zimbabwe was expected to have lost something like $2 billion in those 2 days of mass stairway. What you have is the state unequivocally saying that it's going to respond to those sort of publicly orchestrated violence by the MDC.
Interesting that a totally different account of events from the Zimbabwean government and from the European Union. Let me quote them. They met yesterday, discussed the situation in Zimbabwe, condemned government unprecedented violence and repression, arbitrary arrests of hundreds of opposition supporters. Opposition protests, they said, had been predominantly peaceful, despite serious incidents on the margins of recent demonstrations.
All newspapers in Zimbabwe, 14 of them, have reported the level of violence, the trail of orgy of violence left by the 2 days of demonstrations. Buses bombed, bridges bombed, shops bombed, children in school buses having to be rescued by police and so on. Anybody who says that particular kind of action is defensible is talking an absurd world. That's the situation taking place in Zimbabwe. You have the period leading up to both by-elections have left 5 people dead in Kwadzana and in Highfield, and we've seen MDC parliamentarians being arrested carrying guns at rallies and campaign rallies and so on. Anybody who suggests that is peaceful police demonstration is not paying attention
to what is going on in Zimbabwe.
No, the European Union's comments are no more credible than any other. Certainly in the light of what is happening in the Middle East and Iraq, I don't particularly trust those particular situations. What I am saying is looking at what events in Zimbabwe themselves are doing. And I've looked at the press today. I've been receiving phone calls.
But it is government-controlled press.
The Tribune is not government-controlled. The Daily News is not government-controlled. The Daily Mirror is not government-controlled. Kwaedza is not government-controlled. You can name them endlessly controlled. You can name them endlessly.